Today I want to talk about the imagination. On the list of words that cause problems for human beings is the word image. A company I know has the advertising tagline, "We create image." A commonly understood image can create a powerful effect on the person who perceives the image in the manner that the advertiser wants. The word image, in some respects, has diminished in meaning for us, perhaps because of its connotation of just shallow appearance. Perhaps in response to the ascendance of other words like archetype and form. Archetype carrying the values ascribed to it by psychology, and form as used by Plato and understood in the philosophical term, we understand those more complex ideas a little more carefully in our own language and thinking. The first tier of theological terms are words like God, being, truth, love, faith. It's likely if you were to ask a theologian to name the 20 most important theological words, I wonder if the word image would even come up. Image is a word that's sometimes treated like a leftover, especially when it comes to theological considerations. Yet, it is one of the central clues to knowing ourselves as human beings. And the idea, however undefined in Genesis, in the passage that I read earlier, it trickles down into the first commandment of the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. Some translations use language that also says not to worship idols or graven images, but there are a number of other ways to look at the original Hebrew, which uses two words that can be translated as image. One version is translated as likeness. In some versions of the Bible, it's in our image and likeness, God created us. Another version is more in a philosophic or theological context and has been interpreted as resemblance, identity, shadow picture, mental image, immortal. The list of proposed synonyms goes on, and the speculation in theological circles goes even farther. The process of making for yourself an image, to me, if understood as belonging to the context of creation, seems particularly powerful. Later, human beings get into trouble with this capacity. In Genesis chapter 6, verse 5 from the King James Version, "And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination in the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." Imagination, the process of making images. Some theologians feel the King James Version use of imagination is not an accurate translation of Hebrew, because at the time of the King James translation, imagination in the English language actually meant something like plotting or devising evil. I'm going to read three versions of the same verse in newer translations, and we can get a sense of at least two differences among them. In the New International Version, "The Lord God saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time." So we have imagination changing to inclination of the thoughts of the human heart. In the Watchtower translation, which is from Jehovah's Witnesses, they say, "Consequently, Jehovah saw that the badness of man was abundant in the earth, and every inclination of the thoughts of his hearts was bad, only bad all the time." And then from the Jewish Publication Society, which publishes the Hebrew Bible, "The Lord saw how great was man's wickedness on earth, and how every plan devised by his mind was nothing but evil all the time." Only the Jewish Publication Society version links thoughts with the mind. All the others use thoughts of the heart. In In 2 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul writes, Christ, who is the image of God. And in Hebrews, in the New Testament, Christ reflects the glory of God and bears the very stamp of his nature, which further complicates the issue. Now we have Christ as the image of God. In Genesis, we have man in the image of God. The Greek word that's often used in the New Testament is icon. And perhaps that's why, perhaps the choice of that word is because of that Hebrew word earlier that's really that pictorial image, that one part of the translation. But there's also another Greek word that's used for image that's like prototype, meaning something that could be built from that prototype into something greater. But what's the consequence of this change? In Genesis, we have man in the image of God. Now, in the New Testament, we have Christ as the image of God. And I ran across in the library up here in the Interpreter's Encyclopedia of the Bible a very interesting little statement. Nothing could make clearer the tremendous impact of the revelation of God in Christ than the fact that it has almost completely obliterated the thought of man being in the image of God and replaced it with the thought of Christ being in the image of God. It's a huge change in the change from the Old Testament to the New Testament in the Bible. I read a lot of other theologians and philosophers outside of the Christian tradition. One of my favorites is Henry Corbin. And Henry Corbin is a scholar of Middle Eastern philosophy and mysticism. And it's actually, I read him before I read Swedenborg, and I didn't know that he wrote about Emanuel Swedenborg. But he wrote a very interesting article, and I'd like to read you a portion of that where he explains Swedenborg's thought, because he does a very good idea. He does a very good job of presenting the ideas. In the first celestial person, the internal person was so well differentiated from the external person that he perceived what belonged to the one internal and to the other external. And he perceived how the Lord governs the external person by means of the internal person. His posterity of the first celestial person being his children, however, experienced an increasing desire for the program that belongs to the external person. Such a radical alteration ensued that people no longer perceived the difference between the internal person and the external person. But imagine that one is indistinguishable from the other. Herein is the origin of that yearning to possess a knowledge that gives possession even of the inaccessible object, inaccessible to all knowledge other than a perception of the faith deriving from love. This yearning shall be the death of the celestial person. In Swedenborg's theology, there are three levels of persons. There is the celestial person who has a direct perception of heaven. And that comes through his relationship with the Lord and through angels and through revelations, visions, and dreams. The spiritual person, the next level down, has a conscience. He doesn't have perception. The third person is the dead person. But the dead person, who may be alive in the physical sense, has neither conscience nor perception. So I've kind of compressed a lot into several paragraphs of text there. So I hope what I'm going to say now is going to make it a little more clear and a little more sense and understandable. The perception, the capacity of perception of the celestial person is derived from the divine that is in them. This celestial person is in the image of God. But what's not permitted is thinking these perceptions derived from his own person. By preferring the external, the material world of the senses, understanding the source of perception was lost. The fallen person got everything upside down. They thought knowledge came from outside into them. They believed they owned the garden. so their perception became a shadow of its former capacity. Now we see the reason for the first commandment. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or in the earth beneath, or in the waters below. Now, let's go back to the second story of creation, one that's not that popular with women. It's a very patriarchal version of history, and so I'd like to reread that in a different way. If we reread it from an inner spiritual and psychological perspective, the human being in a deep sleep splits physically, spiritually, and psychologically. Think of it as just as it is written for men for a moment. And if the woman that's created from the rib is the feminine aspect of a man. If we were to use a psychological term for that, we would call it the animal. But let's turn it around the other way, still considering that this is one being. Because in that first story of creation, God says, let us make man in our image. Who's us? One God. Wouldn't it have made more sense for him to say, let me make man in my image? But it's us. And I think that that's an indication, the internal sense of that is that there is male and female present at the beginning of creation. So if you're a woman, I think what you can do is you can read that and consider the woman to enter a deep sleep. And it's the masculine or the animus part of her that is differentiated. And this psychological, spiritual explanation fits very well with Swedenborg's concept of conjugal love. Because in that form of love, that high form of love, the male and female are joined together and actually form a single angel in heaven. So in the regenerated human being, this person that's combined both aspects into themselves, what happens? Well, what happens is, to quote William Blake, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. In Buddhism, there's two forms of truth. Conceptual truth, truth that the mind understands, and the direct perception of truth. So to quote the Dalai Lama, the Buddha, which is their concept of a whole being, perceives the reality of all phenomena directly and has fully developed compassion. And the statement from Swedenborg says, all perception is faith deriving from love. Well, that's all fine on one level. What does it have to do with the world today? Here we are, nice and snug inside this small and beautiful building in San Francisco, while in Lebanon, Israel, and Iraq, violence seems to reach new levels both physically and psychologically. So I'd like to start the next part of my sermon with a quote from Gandhi. It's a paraphrase. Those who believe God has nothing to do with politics don't know anything about politics. And they don't know anything about God either. So to put this into context, I'm going to ask us to use our imagination. And I'm going to ask you to close your eyes for a minute, and we're going to take a journey. And I'd like you to imagine that you're in a room exactly halfway around the world. And the room that you're in is actually very similar to this room. But instead of sitting on chairs, you're sitting on the floor with a prayer mat. On one side of the room, men are listening to the sermon. On the other side of the room, women are listening to the sermon. front of the two groups is a man in robes speaking. And he just finishes his sermon. And you realize that word for word, he has just delivered the same sermon to you that I have delivered here so far. Now you can open your eyes. Let me give you some perspective on your imaginary journey. If you go 180 degrees around the world at exactly the same latitude as San Francisco, you will be within 200 miles of a major city. Can anybody guess what that is? No, that's close. No? Tehran, Iran. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Henry Corbin. Henry Corbin wrote about Emanuel Swedenborg because of his study of Islamic mysticism. Now, he was a scholar of Middle Eastern philosophy and mysticism, but of a particular kind, Ismaili mysticism, which is one form of Shiite Islamic mysticism. Most Iranians are Shiite Muslims. Not all of them are mystics, but what is Swedenborg, or what is Corbin, doing writing an essay about Swedenborg? Well, I was very careful in the very first part of my sermon in talking about the internal sense of Genesis and the other aspects of theology. If you were to take that sermon, you could preach it in an Ismaili mosque. And they would understand everything that I just said in the first part of my sermon. Even the ideas that I expressed about psychology would come up in that group, because the chances are that they're a very highly educated group of people. Even the ideas about Christ being in the image of God. And the interesting thing to me is that the mystics in Iran might feel somewhat like we do, living in a group, living in a country run by literal-minded fundamentalists. Now, we use our imagination for a relatively simple exercise. It's not too hard to think about being in a building or whatever. But you can use your imagination in very spiritual ways. In fact, imagination we think of as being used with the arts or singing, with music, dance. How do we dream up things that don't exist? Well, some mystics consider the imagination to be a spiritual organ that we all have, one that senses spiritual things, one that is the thing that we use to see and understand God. I'm going to read from the prophet Ezekiel. And if we think of him being in relationship to God and wanting to see, we can understand a little bit about what he sees and why he sees it. Now, in the beginning, in the very first chapter of Ezekiel, he sees this vision coming out of heaven where these wheels are turning and things like that. And then there came a voice from above the vault over the heads as they stood with lowered wings, the angels on top of these wheels. And above the vault over their heads was what looked like a throne of lapis lazuli. And high above on the throne was a figure like that of a man. I saw that from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire. And that from there down, he looked like fire. and brilliant light surrounded him. That same visionary experience is described over and over in Islamic mysticism. Theophanies, visions of God like the one in the first chapter of Ezekiel, are what they call in Islam creative imagination. In Shiite Islam, these visions of the spiritual world are just as carefully described and taught by religious scholars and considered to be part of their history, just the way scholars in our universities teach history as chronological events that we see. They teach them side by side. World history, secular events, the events of the imagination, the events of the mind, the events of their contact or visions of God. I think we need to recover as human beings the full meaning of what being in the image of God means. And we need to find positive ways to use our imagination as organs of perception to help us find the place where God in us meets the divine. It's external to us as well as internal. We need to find that place where that God is, whether it's here, or Iraq, or Iran, or Lebanon, or Israel, or any other part of San Francisco. The German mystic Jakob Demme said, through imagination and an earnest, serious desire, we become again impregnated with the deity and receive the new body in the old. This active imagination to me sounds very much like Swedenborg's perception in the celestial person. And that's what I believe we're being invited to do. We're being invited to return to being a celestial person. One that perceives truth directly. One that understands that we are images of God in the fullest sense of the words. And we're being asked to use our imagination to discover the meaning of Christ. Perhaps because we share an understanding of the inner meaning of Genesis with some Shiites, and perhaps because we share in Genesis the origin of our faith, we can use our imagination to find common political ground with Shiite Muslims. I don't know the answers to the conflicts that exist in the world. But if I could use spiritual perception, call on a prophetic voice like the one described in today's reading by Swedenborg, I would say something like this. I would say to those who speak of freedom and tell us that they defend freedom by manly war, that if one of us is chained or enslaved, none of us are free. If the price of our freedom is the subjugation or enslavement of another human being, either physical, psychological, or economic, then our means of practicing freedom have been corrupted by evil, and we no longer understand or know freedom. The 9/11 Commission report, for all of its supposed inaccuracies, has one truth that I have not seen discussed very widely. The Commission said that one of the failures of our security and intelligence was a failure of the imagination. War is a failure of the imagination. A failure that sees limited alternatives and does not recognize opportunity. At one point in a recent film called Everything is Illuminated, an old woman is laying in a field in Eastern Europe, dying. Everyone around her is dead or dying, martyrs of the Holocaust. She turns to the person next to her and says something that rings true today. We live in biblical times. Indeed, we need the living, active imagination of prophets in the truest sense of the word. One who speaks on behalf of a higher moral power. I'd like to finish my sermon today with a short poem. I dreamed of meeting God, the unrevealed one. And we complained to each other about the same things. Lies about love and salvation. Lies about the end of suffering. Lies about knowledge and truth. And God promised me, there is not a hidden purpose to life. I asked, what is most bothersome? God replied, the expectation of reward and revenge. I was silent. God got up to leave and said, no one dreams alone.